Welcome, welcome, welcome to Staying Power, a show that is all about resilience. What it is, what it isn't, how do we know if we have it? What do we do if we realize we don't have it or we don't have as much of it as we would like? Well, whatever the case may be for you, the important thing to remember is resiliency, in the end, is a choice. And with me once again this week to talk about all the different ways that we have helped people around the world develop their own resilience is my friend, my colleague, my co-host, my co-author on a book that we're working on, Tani Santabria. Tani, how are you?
I'm great.
That's a lot.
I'm great. I know. I always feel like, or something. There should be some kind of like, you know, woo.
Yeah, like you should be coming out of a curtain, right? With
totally. Yes.
You know. Yeah, yes. I feel like the old, you know, the Johnny Carson show, you know, calling out the guest. Mm-hmm. How are you?
I am great. Yeah, doing pretty well.
Good. Good. Yeah, good. Yeah,
loving spring so far.
I know. Spring is great, isn't it? More light and more warmth, which is really cool. So important things for resilience, right? Warmth, light, however you want to talk about that. Yeah, exactly. Literally or figuratively or emotionally. So anyway, that's what this show is about, and there's so many different stories. We talk about a story every week on this show to illustrate some sort of resiliency, and I like to surprise you, Tani, with these because, you know, it's just fun to see where we go, right? And there's so many different things. So I'm happy to tell you that for the first time in a few weeks, you're not going to be getting any sports stories. So.
Ooh.
Yeah, not that you're okay. Against those, but I'm just saying, you know.
Too much of a good thing is maybe still a good thing. I don't know.
For some of us, yes. But I am going to a place that I know we both have real appreciation for, and that's history. We're going mm-hmm. to, I have a story for you today about somebody that maybe you haven't heard of, but I find her so interesting. Because of a lot of different questions. And to me, the story brings up things like the power of accountability, the power of conscience, and the power that we have to change our minds, even in the midst of a lot of pressure, right? Finding ourselves. So we're going to go back to the 19th century, so the 1800s, and we're going to go back to 1881. And 1881, I mean, that's kind of one of those years, Tani, where people look back in the history books and they go, I don't really remember anything significant that happened in 1881, you know, in the United States. Well, if you lived in 1881, it was a significant year because that year a president was assassinated. That was President Garfield. President Garfield was shot by a disgruntled man who had been hoping for a patronage appointment to be appointed. To a certain job, was shot, and he lingered for a number of days, Garfield did, in the White House before he succumbed to his injuries. And that paved the way, of course, for the vice president to take his spot as president. And that was a man named Chester A. Arthur. And Chester A. Arthur is not seen as one of the great presidents by most people, right? He only served one term, finished out that term, and that was it. And what he was actually known for was being a political crony. Now, this story's not really about him, but I'm giving you some background. He was known as a political crony. He'd been the head of the Customs House in New York City for a number of years earlier in the 1800s. He had, and that was kind of a lucrative position, but particularly with the political bosses that ran New York at the time. So he was kind of seen as this underhanded, kind of back-rubbing yes man. Right. And he'd been appointed to the ticket because he could bring in that vote. And so when he became president, there were a lot of people pretty dismayed and thought that he was going to be just one of those guys who just handed out jobs to people in his own party. And that was the system at the time, a patronage system that if you knew whoever you knew could get you a job in the cabinet, who could get you in the job in the government, there was no civil service law yet or civil service practice. Now, the reason I tell you about Chester A. Arthur is because to tell you about who I'm going to actually talk about. Not long after Garfield was shot, Chester A. Arthur got a letter in the mail from a woman in New York City who self-described herself as an invalid. She was somebody who was homebound. She was not married. She was childless, even though she lived with a bigger family. She lived with a sister and with nieces and nephews in New York in a pretty nondescript apartment. And Arthur received this letter from her that clearly stood out to him, along with the other 22 letters that would follow, because he kept them later in his life. And he ended up burning a lot of his personal papers many years later. But he kept these 23 letters that he got from this person. And in the first one, she said to him, well, how unfortunate the situation is for you, not just because President Garfield has been shot, but because the only reason that you're going to be president is because he got shot. That must be a really terrible thing for you. And this woman's name was Julia Sands. She was, remember, the context of the time, women did not have the right to vote. Most women were not eligible, depending on the state they lived in, to even serve in any sort of office. Some Western states women could, but not New York. And so this was somebody, because she was, you know, she was educated but self-educated. She ended up writing a book later in life, a short book about George Eliot that never really went anywhere. But she taught herself to read. She taught herself poetry. She and her family were very interested in politics. She kind of grew up around that. But this was somebody who just decided to reach out to Chester A. Arthur because she thought there was more to him, as she said in one of her letters, than he had shown in his political career. And he had an opportunity as president, she thought, to listen to his conscience if he could discover it, as she put it. She kind of expected him to be one of those cronies and just kind of dish those things out. Well, again, this is in 1881. And between 1881 and 1883, she wrote him these 23 letters, each one of them pointing out something to him that she thought was important. There was a chance that he was going to pass the Chinese Exclusion Act that would have banned Chinese from emigrating to the United States. She thought that was a bad idea. She leaned on him to veto that. He did eventually veto that, but then he signed on to a lesser bill and she ripped him in another one of these letters. What stood out in all of these letters were those two things, really critiquing him in a way that he probably wasn't used to. And two, she wasn't asking anything from him. Now, we don't know why he kept these other than they were so unique in that regard, but she wasn't asking for anything from him, at least at the front end of this. She wasn't asking for notoriety. She wasn't asking for an office. She wasn't asking for a job. She was just calling upon him as a concerned citizen. As she put it, you need someone who can be objective. What's interesting about this, you know, to kind of keep the story truncated a little bit, is one day he showed up at her house. 2 years down the line, she'd wanted him to visit. She'd invited him to visit if he ever wanted to. It sounds so strange to do that now, right? The idea of a president just showing up. And he managed to do it without the press noticing. And he came to visit her. And based on an account from her nephew, which was the only account that ever survived, he said to her, you clearly have a lot of opinions on how I should be and how I should do things. She wrote to him later, she was very flustered and very disappointed at how it went because her whole family was there and she couldn't have had the experience that she wanted to have with him and all that. But he showed up once. So clearly we know that these really stood out to him. Plus he kept all 23 of them. What's interesting about this is in several of the letters, she targeted him for kind of the underhanded things he may have done when he was a boss politician in New York City earlier in life. And she remembered that. Interestingly enough, towards the end of these letters, Chester A. Arthur shocked everybody in Washington by championing and then signing a new civil service law that was meant to end corruption, that patronage system where politicians could just give anybody they wanted the job they wanted. And it was a way to pay people off. He ended that, which was against his party's platform, was against what he and Garfield had said they would do. And biographers of Arthur have suggested very strongly that it was Julius Sands' letters to him and her ability to hit his conscience, to tap on that somehow, because she wasn't asking anything from him. And then something maybe undefined, because Arthur never wrote about it, but convinced him to go this route and to do something that he perhaps had felt was the right thing to do, but didn't feel he politically could do without suffering consequences. And he did, because even though this passed and was really popular in some quarters, it ended Arthur's political career. He was not going to be able to run. I mean, he didn't have the support of his party to run again. And so it sure looks like that he sacrificed his chance at a second term in office, even though his party was pretty popular, because he did this turnabout to end what many people saw as one of the biggest corrupt practices in American government at the time. And it was seen as kind of a reflection of the whole era of the time, the Gilded Age. Now, it's kind of a sad postscript to the story, but she never got another visit. Julia Sands never got another visit from Chester A. Arthur. He died just a few years later of kidney disease after he left office. And not long after that, she was committed to an asylum in New York City, or excuse me, in outside of New York City, where she lived until 1933 when she died. So she spent the majority of her life away from any of this. And none of this was known until in the 1930s, Chester A. Arthur's grandson got a bunch of these letters that had survived, not many had, opened up one envelope, and here were these 23 letters from Julia Sands, every single one of them kept. And so he put an ad in the newspaper in New York saying, does anybody know Julia Sands? And Julia Sands' nephew, who had been at that meeting when Chester A. Arthur showed up, reached out to him and said, yes, that is my aunt. They got together, put two and two together, and it became the basis for what a lot of biographers and historians of the era wrote about Chester A. Arthur's presidency, because he destroyed so many of his personal papers for reasons that we don't really know. So I just found that a very interesting story on a lot of levels. So I'm wondering what you think of that interesting story, Tawny, when it comes to things like they might have something to do with resilience. I can spot a few.
Well, sure. I mean, it is an interesting story. I love the stories that we don't know. We find out later.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't an advertised situation.
Correct.
It was private for whatever reasons it was private for.
Mm-hmm.
And then we hear, 30, 50, 100 years later, sort of the goings-ons of situations that were pretty pivotal in particular people's lives, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that is true for all of us. In that we have these parts of our lives that people don't know about.
Yeah.
And we're learning from each other, and we're sharing our opinions, or we're tapping into each other's sort of conscience or just like moral, or just what it is to be a human, to help other humans.
Mm-hmm.
And those things aren't always advertised. They're just for the two people to sort of help gauge or and guide, right? And influence what then comes next in a person's life.
Right.
So I love those stories, because we all have these, and they're, because they're not advertised, they can go, sort of like underground, or can be forgotten about unless certain things are found at some point and then brought to light.
Mm-hmm.
But how pivotal are so many parts of our lives like this story?
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of like out of nowhere, they occur. And for some reason, then it becomes a connection.
Yeah.
And an influence, right? I think we are here to influence each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, to me, I agree with you. One of the things that's so profound is the majority of things, it seems to me, that really matter the most to us in our lives, that affect us the most, move us the most, not necessarily a lot of people, if any people, are really going to know about. Right? Those are the things that we keep private. Those are the things that only certain people get to know. Right? And in this case, clearly it affected Chester A. Arthur enough that he was willing to take time out of his schedule as president and go visit this person unannounced. And yet he told nobody and didn't want the press to know about it either. You know, I agree with you. These things that move us and shape us. And when we look back and go, I wonder why they did things that way. And then we find them out. There's stories like that, that so often you can't even anticipate them, you know, and then you go, wow, no wonder that had such an effect. Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe sometimes I think the why is important, and maybe sometimes the why isn't. Mm-hmm. Right. Maybe sometimes it's just the acknowledgement of, wow, this is how humans connect.
Yeah.
You know, we get this inkling or we get this urge to sort of express ourselves in a particular way. And when it resonates with another person and draws them in a way that there's some benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly there was benefit ultimately.
Absolutely.
Because that was a significant sort of decision, mm-hmm. That he made, mm-hmm. That benefited a lot of people. So sometimes we don't even realize, like, speaking up in a way that can be heard.
Yeah.
How influential that can be, not just for ourselves, but it can be for quite a number of people. And we don't have to advertise it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Had she advertised it, that would have been a different story.
It would have been a way different story, because then she would have just ended up being like everybody else who was probably writing to him, giving him the impression that she wanted something. To me, that's one thread of the story that I think really seems to resonate with me. She wasn't asking anything of him. She was writing directly to him with that connective piece in mind. And I think what's significant is I should give the context. The civil service laws still exist. They still exist. That was the beginning of the civil service in the United States. So we're talking 150 plus years now of having civil service laws in the U.S. that professionalize all of that, rather than have it be just given out to people's cronies. Kind of a big deal. So it's a big act of legislation in American history. And it happened because of this one person choosing to act on and write based on who she was and how she was.
Yes. And she might have been a catalyst. She might have been the, you know, sort of a space or a place for him to be able to have some openness. Mm-hmm. And then he found a lot of other areas to support that. But I would say she probably was, you've mentioned a couple times, she wasn't asking anything of him. She was asking something of him.
She did want him to visit. Yeah, she wanted him to be different. And she did want him to visit a couple times too. Yeah, she did. And he only visited once. Right.
Yeah, yeah. So, and who knows? Maybe she had written a lot of people before him. Maybe she was a letter writer.
That's,
you know,
true.
And he just happened to be the person or a person that responded or at least took in what she was saying.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows, right? Mm-hmm. But we don't ever really know the significance that we can have in just letter writing or one-on-one conversations. And I think that's fascinating. I love those kinds of stories.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
Yeah. And her own situation, I think, found really interesting as well. Taking advantage or making the most of the time that she had, based on everything that we know about her, because she was sick a lot, because she couldn't be outside a lot. She spent a lot of time reading, a lot of time learning, a lot of time talking with people, building up these ideas at a time when women weren't really encouraged to do that. And it certainly wasn't expected to do that. And never mind write the president of the United States and tell him exactly what you thought of him. You know, there's something in that too, that I find really great about this story, because not only that piece, but then it's just a reminder that at every time in the past of human history, people can be invested in where they are, and what matters to them is right then, right now, what things can be. And for her, it wasn't just this idea of what's happening, but she had a belief that things could be better and wanted to see things be better. There's a real humanness to that that takes it out of the realm oftentimes of when we talk about historical figures, because usually the historical figures we talk about are these really big, great figures, right, who stand out for a lot of reasons. What I love about Julia Sands is that she's such a human that I think we could all relate to no matter when we live.
Yeah. Well, and all of those big people in history have these kinds of people around them.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't get they don't get talked about.
Yeah, no notice.
Yeah. But every single person has these people around them if they are in positions mm-hmm. of being able to make decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Because these the type of people who are going to stay in the background but give their opinion very directly, they're everywhere. We just don't see them
mm-hmm.
because they're not advertising it.
Mm-hmm.
But they're mm-hmm. everywhere, because this world would not be able to be as human as it can be if there weren't for these people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Those are the people that are sort of the glue, right? There's a lot more of them than there are of the real famous historical people.
Well, and even today, even in today's world, there mm-hmm. are a lot of those people who are the voice behind what we see.
Mm-hmm.
Or the voices trying to offer perspective,
mm-hmm.
But that aren't the front people. Yeah. They're the supporters of the people who are speaking.
Yeah.
So we've always had these people. We will always have these people. We just don't get to talk about these people very often.
Mm-hmm.
So today we get to talk about a person such as this.
Mm-hmm. It's great.
How nice is that?
I know. It's great. Because it is something to me that the humanness of her story really stands out, right? There's no heroic ending. There's not even really, it's a life lived. It's a life lived with its particularities, with its peculiarities, with its common elements that other people might have gone through, a lot of things that other people might not have gone through. And it's at a certain time and place. And like you said, right when we first started talking about this, there's a chance nobody would have ever known about this unless certain things happened, right, to bring the attention up and then have somebody put something in the paper and somebody read it. You know, it's the chance of it. And it always reminds me, as somebody who's interested in history, that what we know of in history is only what we know of, is only what we know, things that have been written down or recorded or seen or that type of thing. But the majority of stories are not written down. The majority of these points that we connect on as people don't ever get written down. They don't need to, right? That's just part of being human. But that's where the majority of our stories are, are in the quiet places that don't get written down. And I think a story like this kind of underscores how important it is, whether we know it or not, whether we know the story or not, how important those types of things really are.
Yeah. So going back to sort of appreciating our ordinary,
mm-hmm.
appreciating our day to day, our moment to moment. And we're all so focused on doing something. So many of us are focused on doing something grand, doing something huge, mm-hmm. doing something big.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're in our day to day and we're aware, and we're able to express ourselves in our day-to-day with the people around us. Or writing, I mean, like certainly back in the day it was writing letters, right? Because there wasn't, we didn't have the ability to speak with people or any other way that weren't in our household or that weren't in our community, right?
Right.
So now we have that access to sort of be thinking about doing all the big things via all the ways in which we can get the attention of other people. But if we draw it back into our day-to-day, if we draw it back into our circle and who's in our community, who's in our family, and we're sort of focused there and enjoying those moments, like those are most of our lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And being able to appreciate that as opposed to wishing we were living on a grander scale.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. I like that. We were joking at the top about you coming out from curtains and, you know, that type of thing. Not that grand scale, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, and it's for me, you know, I've wondered before with this story. You know, clearly Julia Sands was able to connect. There was something in her writing, something in her approach, something about her that connected, that Chester A. Arthur felt this connection around and importance around. And clarity around. And I've asked myself before, who's the Julia Sands in my life? And I know who they are. You know they are the ones who can reach me. The ones that in a way that is really difficult and impossible to explain, it doesn't need to be, I connect with like that. I think that's what makes the story so real and so compelling and so interesting for people when they hear it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Dial it all the way down into just moment to moment to moment. And we can all relate to wanting to say what we want to say. And then how great that feels when somebody hears us.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, awesome. There we go.
Mm-hmm.
Julia Sands, everybody. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, great story. A very interesting story with a very profound set of things in it. So thanks, Tawny, so much for that. Appreciate your insight.
Thank you.
All right, and thank you for listening to this episode of Staying Power. Remember, if you missed any of this episode or any of our episodes, you can get this as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for subscribing, for reviewing, for sharing with your friends, your family, your social networks, anybody you think would benefit from learning more about their own resilience and how they can build it and what they can choose in terms of building it. Remember, if you subscribe, you get a little mini podcast during the week called The Four Tips, 4 Points, 4 Ideas for things that you can try out to help build resilience in your everyday life. So if you subscribe, you get that. Until next week, I am JDK Winnikin.
And I am Tawny Santabria.
Write some letters.